Okay, we're going to continue with what man ought to believe concerning God. We're at questions 12 in the larger catechism and question 7 in the shorter catechism. Question 12, what are the decrees of God? Answer, God's decrees are the wise, free, and holy acts of the counsel of his will, whereby from all eternity he hath for his own glory unchangeably foreordained whatsoever comes to pass in time, especially concerning angels and men. Question 7 of the Shorter Catechism, what are the decrees of God? Answer, the decrees of God are his eternal purpose, according to the counsel of his will, whereby for his own glory he hath foreordained whatsoever comes to pass. I want to talk about the nature of the decrees. I want to talk about the end of the decrees, and I also want to talk about the object of the decrees. I really want to talk about the nature, begin to discuss, raise questions, and discuss some of the nature of predestination. And the section that we're about to begin in the catechisms, in the larger catechism, as we'll see, is much fuller again on this question than the shorter catechism. But this is, in fact, one of the most controversial, controverted doctrines that I think has arisen in the church. The question of predestination has been around for quite some time. As we'll see, Paul clearly talks about it. It's alluded to throughout the Old Testament. There were a lot of things that were said, but it really did not become controverted. It did not become a point of contention in the church per se, until the time of Augustine. And then a British monk named Pelagius arose. He was actually a Celtic monk. He arose and put forth certain views regarding grace and nature. And part of the corollary of what he put forth respected the what he believed to be the power of man's free will. Now, the question of free will is not something that we're going to directly address in the catechisms. The Westminster Confession has an entire chapter devoted to that question, and it's something that we deal with in the course of dealing with the Westminster Confession. We're not denying that man has quote-unquote free will. What we are denying and we will deny is that man has what might be called libertarian free will, the ability equally to choose good or evil, that which is spiritually profitable or that which is spiritually detrimental. That ability went out with the fall. Whatever ability man had to choose the one versus the other, in the course of the fall, man lost all ability to choose good. But that's not really our purpose in this section yet anyway. So there are things that we're going to be talking about in the course of the catechisms that have bearing on that question. We will talk about that issue, that is, how predestination directly relates to man and his ability. There are questions in the catechisms that, in fact, cover that, but perhaps not as directly as the confession itself does, certainly not in as much detail. Our concern right now is to consider the matter of the decrees of God. And it's interesting because the Catechism questions both ask what are the decrees of God. If you remember, in the Westminster Confession in Chapter 3, we talk about God's eternal decree, singular. Now we're talking about decrees. Well, how did that happen? Why did that happen? The reason for the difference in language, I think, is this. The Confession is dealing with it as a theological proposition, as a matter of confession. The Catechisms are dealing with the decrees of this eternal decree as it respects the creature. And as it respects the creature, this decree has many objects or many tendencies. It works itself out in a lot of different respects. And so from our perspective, it looks like decrees. And so the Catechisms are really asking questions which are designed to take us from where we are back to this idea of the eternal decree. Whereas the Confession is simply setting out that there is an eternal decree. So we'll have reason to come back to that again in a few minutes. When we talk about the decrees of God, it's important that we recognize that we have now moved from talking about not only what God is and how God is and who is God. We're not now talking so much about what we would call the theology proper. We're beginning to move into the realm of that which is communicable. So the decree of God is really the point at which the hidden purposes of God are in fact poised to become revelations in creation and providence. The decree of God is really talking about God in potentia, his hidden power. When we talk about creation and providence, we'll be talking about God in actuality, that is, his work in actuality. So the decree of God is the work of God put in power, potentia, in potentia. It's the potential. And creation and providence are really that decree in actuality, as we'll see in a moment. And we're going to underscore that, and I just want to point out, we're going to come back to this as well, that this is something that in God there's really no difference. We distinguish between potentia, what is potential, and what is actual. But in God, and as we contemplate this as the beginning of the works of God, this potential and the actualizing are all the same thing. This is why, for example, in confusion about this, remember when we talked about God, we talked about him as being the most simple being. There's an absoluteness to his simplicity. So that his potential and his actualizing really are not two different things. We're contemplating them in two different ways, but they're not only not unrelated because of who and what and how God is. They're also not, in fact, ultimately distinguishable. You know, what God decrees is what is. Now you you may purpose. You may, in fact, direct your potentia and never be able to actualize it. Because you're a creature. With God, that's not the case. And that's an important thing to remember here. This is a place where I think a lot of people get mixed up. You know, if you deny the eternal predestination of God, one of the consequences of that is you have, in essence, afflicted God with a human conception of limitation. Because creatures are limited in that way, you are now conceiving of God as being limited in that way as well. Because it is potentially separable, you know, our power from our act, our potential from our actualization, because it's separable in us, it's clearly distinguishable in us, one does not necessitate the other in us, to then reason from that that, well, it must be this way in God, is to make God out to be like the creature. So it's important as we go through this that we understand this question is not just a question about the works of God or the beginning of the works of God. It is about that. And it does have bearing on the doctrine of creation, the doctrine of providence, and ultimately this idea of redemption. It has tremendous bearing on all of these questions that are controverted regarding predestination. There's no doubt that it has bearing on all of this. It does, and it should. But God, because of what God is, being a simple being, this question is really designed to help us understand that the omniscience and the omnipotence and the omnipresence of God ultimately are all the same thing. The people who deny the doctrine of eternal predestination are in fact trying to interpret God in conceptions that have been formed according to creaturely being rather than the being of the creator. And the perfection of the being of the creator, the perfection of the agency of the creator, the perfection that is that eternal being, lies behind this discussion. So, the decree of God is really the beginning of all of our discussion of everything that will follow from here on out in the Catechism, because we're moving from contemplating God in himself to contemplating God with respect to his creation. We're in the process of turning from those internal works, which are unknown to us except by revelation, special revelation, those things which constitute the divinity, and it constitutes really a bad word here because God is a simple being. He's not really, he's not complex. So there's no constitution in the sense of a bunch of parts being put together or mixed together or anything like that. Right. When I say constitute the divinity, what I mean is underlie. It is foundational to the conception of the divinity. It's not that our conception is constituting, but our conception is constituted in our minds, the way we're thinking about this. Right. That these questions now, we're turning from this contemplation of God in himself to a contemplation of God and his actions as they move from being internal and self-word, that is God-word, to being toward the creation, toward the creature. And it's precisely because of the nature of the divinity, the nature of God, that we're going to say a number of things that we're going to say concerning the decrees of God. If we understand his simplicity, if we understand that what we've already said regarding his sovereignty. Now, if his sovereignty ultimately is his omniscience and omnipresence and omnipotence, these are really all the same thing. Remember that imagery I've talked about, you know, that prism. Behind the prism, it's all white light. As the light comes through the prism, we see different colors of breakdown of the spectrum. But those are the decrees of God, but behind that is that eternal decree. We know that there's a singularity of mind, of will. And it is, in fact, a mind and a will that is so perfectly self-existent that it stands in need of nothing else to bring information. You know, the idea that these process theologians have, that, you know, God is learning. God doesn't know what's going to happen to tomorrow because tomorrow hasn't really happened yet. God does know, because God has already decreed what's going to happen tomorrow. And what God has decreed will determine what happens tomorrow. And that in no way is going to compromise the will of the creature. Creatures will in fact do every creature that's taken into his purpose will do what it wants to do. You know, it's going to do what it wants to do, ultimately, you know, within its power, what it wants to do within its own power. Like God limits its powers, but that's the nature of the creature. You know, God is not forcing anyone, and we'll talk about that along the way as well. So we want to talk about the decree of God. And the first question then is, what is the nature of the decrees? I want to consider this, that for God to decree is for God to purpose and foreordain, to will and to appoint that a thing shall be or not be. Ephesians 1:11.
Ephesians 1:11. In whom also we have obtained an inheritance, being predestinated according to the purpose of him who worketh all things after the counsel of his own will.
Yeah, so he's working all things after the counsel of his own will. That is to tell us, he has purpose. He's foreordained, which is, again, to say that before it happens, God has already purposed what will happen in the creation. He's not going to get caught by surprise. You're not going to do something tomorrow and God's going to say, I have to revise my entire plan now. That happens to men all the time. You know, things happen and you have to revise your plan. Especially plans of men, of mice and men, right, often come to naught. But not God. You know, the reason our plans can be thwarted is not everything is within our control. we don't have the power to actualize all that we desire or purpose. But in God, the power and the actualizing are equal to the desire. There's no difference. So he does everything according to the good pleasure of his own will. He's willed or appointed that something shall be or shall not be. Right? There are things that are not. Why are they not? You know, why, to use the example that Jesus uses, you know, when he speaks of the hypothetical, you know, had Jesus, or what he was saying, had that been preached in the days of Sodom, they would have repented. Or why wasn't it then? Well, God clearly did not desire that. He did not will that. He did not appoint that. He didn't foreordain that. And does Jesus really know that? Well, he has perfect knowledge of all things. Because his perfect knowledge of all things, he in fact can bring about exactly what he desires to be brought about. And that without, as the confession notes in this, without doing violence to the will of the creature. You know, God is able to do whatever he wants, and at no time does he find it necessary to do anything that is contrary to the will of the creature, except, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this now, I'm just going to mention this in passing, except in the matter of salvation. God has to bind us and drag us kicking and screaming because we don't want to be saved. So apart from that, you know, everything God is doing is according to the will of the creature. Now, in all creatures, the fact is there's this distinction between potency or power and act or actualization, whereby the creature may fall short of the power to actualize his purpose. Proverbs 16:9.
A man's heart deviseth his way, but the Lord directeth his steps.
A man's heart deviseth his way. That is to say, you plot and you plan. You think in your mind, I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that. But ultimately, Solomon says, it's the Lord directing your way. You might think you're going to do this. You might think you're going to do that. The fact is, you don't have the power to actualize everything that you purpose. But you always do will to fulfill, to accomplish that which you do. Right? So you may not be able to do everything you want to do, but what you do, you do willingly. That's because there's this distinction between potency or power and act or actualization. It's not the same thing in the creature, but in God, the decree is in fact the guarantee of the act. So that in this sense, his decrees are already incipient acts. Look at Isaiah 46:10-11.
Isaiah 46:10-11. Declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. Calling a ravenous bird from the east, the man that executeth my counsel from a far country, yea, I have spoken it, I will also bring it to pass, I have purposed it, I will also do it.
So, God, when God decrees, it's the guarantee that the act will take place. So when the larger catechism says God's decrees are the wise, free, and holy acts of the council of his will, the reason they can say that his decrees are also acts is not because acts and decrees are exactly the same thing in us, but they are in him. His decree is a guarantee of the act. If he's decreed it, it's going to happen, right? The act will follow. The actualization will follow. It's not just the power, but there will be the actualization because there's the power, there's the act, and there's also that desire. God is going to do whatever he purposes. So all of these things are the same. They really converge in God because he's the most simple being. There's no disconnect. He doesn't have more desire than he does power, or power than he does act, or act than he does desire. These things are all the same. So much so that we can say the decrees are the acts of God. In this sense, it's clear that men's purposes or decrees are distinct from themselves. That is, when men purpose, when men decree, that's something distinct from the man. The man and his desire or his power or his act, they're not exactly the same thing. But the decrees of God are not distinct from himself. Look at
Hebrews 6:17. Wherein God, willing more abundantly to show unto the heirs the promise, the immutability of his counsel, confirmed it by an oath.
The immutability of his counsel. What is the apostle talking about? How can his counsel be immutable? It's not immutable in you or in me, but we're creatures. Our desires are, in fact, vacillating. They flutter. Sometimes they're up, sometimes they're down. Our power, the potency, sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not. The actualization. Well, you know, if you have the power to actualize, but you don't have the desire, it's not going to be actualized, right? On the other hand, if you have the desire, but you don't have the power, it's also not going to be actualized. But in God, there is no lack in any of these things that we're talking about. So they're not distinct from himself. Who God is and what God does ultimately are the same. Why do I say that? Look, God's decrees are nothing else but God himself, who is one simple act. How can I say that? Look at Romans. I want to compare Romans 11:34 with Proverbs 23:7.
Romans 11:34. For who hath known the mind of the Lord, or who hath been his counsel? Proverbs 23:7. For as he thinketh in his heart, so is he. Eat and drink, saith he to thee, but his heart is not with thee.
Yeah, as he thinketh in his heart, so is he. Well, who has known the mind of God? Who's known the mind of the Lord? As he thinks in his heart, so he is. Well, how do we know what he's thinking? Well, because he's decreed it, and what he's decreed will be actualized. God is one simple act in this respect. The decrees of God are nothing else but God himself. You can't separate them from God. You know, you can separate a man from his decree, but you can't do that with God, because God is the most simple being. His agency is the most simple. He's one act. It's really the eternal decree. And the eternal decree is according to the eternal good pleasure. And the result is the execution of that decree in creation and providence, as we will see in a couple of weeks, Lord willing. Now, God's decrees, as I said, they're many only in respect of their objects, not as they are in God. Look at Ephesians 1:9.
Ephesians 1:9, having made known unto us the mystery of his will, according to his good pleasure, which he himself purposed.
Yeah, I want you to think about the language that the apostle uses there. It's the mystery of his will, not wills. It's his good pleasure, not good pleasures. And it's his purpose, not purposes. So as this respects God, it's his eternal decree. But as it respects us, there, you know, or the creation, there are numerous objects. So as we see the effects of the decree in creation and providence, what we see is akin to that light going through the prism. We see the breaking up, and we can see red and yellow and blue and all of the other colors of the rainbow coming through that prism. But as we go back through that prism on the other side, it's really all the same thing. There's really just the decree of God. So be clear on that, that, you know, there's a reason why we, on the one hand, we talk about the decrees of God. When we're doing that, we are contemplating that eternal decree as it is, in fact, facing us, as it is, in fact, being illuminated in creation and providence. Revealed in creation and providence. But as it respects God, as it respects his eternal good pleasure, it's singular, it's simple, just like God himself. Simple. Right? Such decrees must be granted since God is absolutely perfect. Job 12:13.
Job 12:13. With him is wisdom and strength. He hath counsel and understanding.
And therefore we can say that nothing can come to pass without his will. Isaiah 28:29.
Isaiah 28:29. This also cometh forth from the Lord of hosts, which is wonderful in counsel and excellent in working.
The wonderful in counsel, excellent in working. There is an excellency, peculiar excellency. What is it? God's counsel works. Counsel of men, not so much. The counsel of men, that can fall to the ground, but the counsel of the Lord is never going to fall to the ground. His counsel is an expression of his desire. Because he is sovereign, he is omnipotent, because he's omniscient, omnipresent. The fact is that the counsel of his will work, be actualized. There's an excellence in that. You know, he's not going to be thwarted. There's nothing that's going to happen where God is going to have to step back and say, wait a minute, I didn't see that one. That one came from out of nowhere. I don't know. We need to take a time out so I can consider what to do next. There's nothing going on like that with God. You know, a lot of American churches in particular, I think, have so anthropomorphized the nature of the divinity that men not only don't see the reality of the sovereignty of God and the necessity of these decrees from God, this idea of the eternal decree, they don't see that a proper view of God is going to lead you to this. Their improper doctrine of God has led them not only to reject the decree or the decrees of God, but it's led them to reject the sovereignty of grace. It's led them to reject all kinds of things. Ultimately, it's led them to reject the true God. Because the conception of God that is not according to the Word of God is an idol of your own making. You know, if you conceive of a God that simply does not have the perfection and the power and the agency, the desire, the decree, the act, in order to bring to pass whatsoever he desires for his own glory, then we're talking about a different God altogether than the God of the Bible. And that's the problem. Right, thus, in this decreeing or foreordaining, it must not be supposed to be God determining things in such a way that would argue any imperfection in the divine mind. Look at Proverbs 8:14.
Proverbs 8:14. Counsel is mine, and sound wisdom. I am understanding. I have strength.
God is not, again, the divine mind is not in any way subject to any kind of imperfection. Now, I want to remind you, the word imperfect means that there's some lack of completion there. The perfection of God's mind, the divine mind, is arguing that there is a completion. The divine mind is, in fact, a complete thing in and of itself. There's no imperfection there. So that he has all counsel. So that this foreordaining, this decreeing, he doesn't do it as a result of any kind of deliberation. Right? He's not sitting back debating matters within himself. It's not like you trying to work through some sort of a problem. You know, where you're trying to figure out, should I do this or should I do that? What might happen if I do this versus if I do that? God isn't, he's not in any way bounded by that. The reason we have those kinds of deliberations is we don't have control of everything. And we don't know the future. You know, we don't have control over the future. And we argue and we debate things within ourselves because we're trying to gain some control over the future, which is very often futile. Right? There's no reasoning in his own mind about the expediency or the inexpediency of things. God isn't saying, well, I guess if I did this, it would be more efficacious. If I do that, well, that'll be more efficacious. No. Whatever God does is, in fact, efficacious because what God does is all powerful. And there's no power apart from God. There's no calling in of the advice of others. Now that would, again, that would imply that there was some sort of lack. Look at Isaiah 40, verses 13 and 14.
Isaiah 40, 13 and 14. Who hath directed the Spirit of the Lord, or being his counselor, hath taught him?
with whom took he counsel, and who instructed him, and taught him in the path of judgment, and taught him knowledge, and showed to him the way of understanding?
Yeah, it's a rhetorical. Those are all rhetorical questions. The answer is no one. You haven't done it. I haven't done it. No one has done it. Why? Well, God doesn't need any of that. God is a most perfect being. He doesn't stand in need of. There's no lack. He's not missing something here. This idea that he needs to wait and consult with you or me to decide, well, should I save this person or that person? Or should I save you? Does it need to consult? There's no expediency or inexpediency for that matter. Is whatever God decrees is right and just and good and holy and wholly efficacious. Now, I want to underscore what the larger catechism then says here. These decrees, because of what we said, they are then to be accounted most wise, which is to say that they do not exhibit any imperfection of conception.
Romans 11:33. Oh, the depth of the riches both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out.
Yeah, how unsearchable are his judgments and ways past finding out. There is no imperfection here. There's not a lack. You know, it's not as if God says, look, let's do this, and wait a minute now, we have to reconsider. No, let's do this now, because I forgot to take that into account. Again, that happens to men all the time. At least if they're wise, it does, because men cannot take everything into account. So they keep changing what they're going to do. Okay. Any man who would follow through a plan without taking a continual accounting, really does not exhibit wisdom. No, the fact is there's an old adage that, you know, all of the planning of battles, they end as soon as the first shot is fired. You know, at that point, all battle plans become obsolete, because at that point, everything you thought begins to go right out the door, and you have to begin to improvise. You have to begin to take into account what's going on. That's why we need, you know, military commanders. That's why we have people who are in those kinds of positions to redirect and continually reshape the action on the battlefront. Why? Because we don't have control of the forces. But that's not so with God. He has control of everything. There's no imperfection in his conception. There's nothing that's being left out. There's nothing in his conception that's unenforceable. You know, a great military commander, he may have wonderful, wonderful conception, but it's not going to, as good as he might be, it'll never have the perfection that God has, because he can't control the whole the whole theater of war. But God controls the entire theater of the creation. There's nothing outside of his control. And so his conception in these decrees is marked by every perfection, because he knows it all inside out. He not only knows it all inside out, the fact is that he has all power and all ability to carry out all his good pleasure, his desire. Right? Beyond that, beyond being wise, most wise, we can see these decrees are most free, whereby, what I mean is this, they are subject to no external consideration, nor do they arise in any way involuntarily. I look at Romans 9, 14, 15, and 18.
Romans 9, 14, and 15. What shall we say then? Is there unrighteousness with God? God forbid. For he saith to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. And 18. Therefore hath he mercy on whom he will have mercy, and whom he will he hardeneth.
Yeah, God's decree or decrees, they're not only wise, most wise, but they're most free because there is nothing outside of God which is in any way moving him to do this or to do that, to amend his plan, to change his tactic. Nor is there anything that is going to cause there to arise in this decree something involuntary. That is to say, there's nothing in the decree of God which is not there as, strictly speaking, a matter of his will, which means it's there according to his good pleasure, which means it's there, in fact, fully within the realm of his potency or his power to act, and therefore it is actualized, becomes actual. It's most free. Finally, as are all the works of God, these decrees are most holy.
Psalm 145:17. The Lord is righteous in all his ways, and holy in all his works.
Yeah, holy in all his works. What do we mean by that? Well, again, when we talk about the holiness of God, we're talking about, in fact, that idea that he is separate. His works are, in fact, most holy. They are works which, although they impinge and they impact upon the creation, they are in no way dependent upon, informed, or, in fact, are the result of a consideration of that creation. The works arise solely and wholly from God most freely. And as a result of that, they're most holy. And furthermore, these decrees do not depend upon the existence of time in order to become determinations, but in fact they are the very knowing which determines all that pertains to time. Acts 15, verse 18.
Known unto God are all his works from the beginning of the world.
Yeah, he knows all his works from the beginning of the world. Why does he know them? Because he's determined them. And if he knows them, it's very clear that he's already guaranteed them to be. They're not dependent upon the existence of time, but everything which pertains to time and exists in time is, in fact, dependent upon them. Now, when we talk, and when the larger catechism talks about he's unchangeably foreordained whatsoever comes to pass in time, especially concerning angels and men, I would point out that in some sense, angels are beings which inhabit eternity and not time, primarily. although they do in fact penetrate time. They are creatures which are not based in time like we are. And so this predestination does affect them, as we will see, but it is not, the predestination really pertains to all creatures, whether or not they are time-bound. Angels, being purely spirit beings, are not subjected to the duration of time like our men, who have corporeal bodies. Our bodies make us subject to time. That part of us which ties us into time. All right, the second question. What is the object of God's decrees? Or we could say objects. The object or objects of God's decrees is whatsoever comes to pass. So that nothing comes to pass but what he's decreed to come to pass, and that from all eternity. Ephesians 1, 4, and 11.
Ephesians 1, verse 4. According as he hath chosen us in him before the foundation of the world, that we should be holy and without blame before him. Verse 11. In whom also we have obtained an inheritance, being predestinated according to the purpose of him who works with all things after the counsel of his own will.
So the object then of God's decree has to do with everything that comes to pass pertaining to the creation, and it is from all eternity. That is to say that this predestination arises not in time, but in eternity, because it is, in fact, a determination. The decree of God is a determination that arises within himself without reference to creation. In fact, as we'll see in just a moment here, the very act of creating is part of this eternal determination. So first of all, what I've said, God has decreed to create all things which have a being. We want to look at Psalm 104, 24 and 25.
Psalm 104, 24 and 25. O Lord, how manifold are thy works, and wisdom hast thou made them all. The earth is full of thy riches. So is this great and wide sea, wherein are things creeping innumerable, both small and great beasts.
God's decree as we will talk about later, his decree begins with the decree to create. And he's going to create all things out of nothing. In the space of 6 days, and all very good, right? Catechism. But we'll get to that. The fact is that he's created all things which have a being. And that means that there is no being in all of the creation. There's no being independent. Independence of being is, in fact, an attribute of the divine nature alone. There is no other independent being. All created being is actually necessarily dependent being. It's dependent upon the creator. So he's decreed to create. Why would we say that? I mean, because as we'll see when we begin to consider in more detail the predestination of men and angels, that consideration that he has predestined very clearly, as we'll see, men and angels, that implies that he's predestinated everything necessary to that predestination. So in order to predestinate men and angels, he first must, in fact, decree to create everything. Create all things which are going to have a being. And these being decreed in order to fulfill the good pleasure of his own will. Revelation 4:11.
Revelation 4:11. Thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power, for thou hast created all things, and for thy pleasure they are and were created.
For thy pleasure they are and were created. Again, this is the same language we find with the doctrine of predestination. He predestined everything according to the good pleasure of his own will. This is good pleasure. So he's created. Why? It's a matter of his good pleasure. The Greek word for good pleasure is eudokia. It's the thing, it's his good dokia. It's the thing that brings him glory. A second, God has decreed not only to create, but to rule and govern all the creatures which he was to make. Romans 11:36.
Romans 11:36, for of him and through him and to him are all things, to him be glory forever. Amen.
Of him and to him and through him are all things. And that's the doctrine of providence, right? So God has decreed both to create and to rule and govern, which is providence. He's decreed that not only to create, but to exercise a providential rule. Now, this government, and I want to emphasize this now because this is going to come up several places. People generally, I'm not saying everyone, but generally, if people are going to object to predestination and they start saying stupid things like, well, that makes us all puppets, so can't do anything, God's just created us to send us to hell, yeah. The fact is, let's get this out of the way, the government of God, this providential rule, includes not only the good, but the evil. Again,
Ephesians 1:11. Ephesians 1:11. In whom also we have obtained an inheritance, being predestinated according to the purpose of him who worketh all things after the counsel of his own will.
He's the counsel of his own will. He's predestinated all things, not just good things, but all things. The Greek word there, panta, just all, everything. The evil of punishments, in fact, if we consider evil as evil punishments, is actually truly a good thing. Being the execution of a just judgment against those set in opposition to the divine will. So, for example, Amos 3:6.
Amos 3:6. Shall a trumpet be blown in the city, and the people not be afraid? Shall there be evil in a city, and the Lord have not done it?
Yeah, he's talking about evil in the city. He's talking about judgment, the evil of punishment or judgment coming. Amos is saying, look, the Lord has done that. There is an evil in punishment, but that evil is really received by the creature. It's not, when we consider it in and of itself, it's not really evil. It is, in fact, the just judgment of God, and that's a good thing. Now, with respect to the evil of sin, sin is that permission to act contrary to the revealed will of God. Even that, the evil of sin, that too, the government includes that in order that the greater good of God's secret will might be brought to pass. Look at Acts 2:23.
Him being delivered by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God, he hath taken and by wicked hands have crucified and slain.
Right. This latter kind of evil, this evil of sin, is in fact spoken of by our Lord in Matthew 18:7.
Matthew 18:7, woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs be that offenses come, but woe to that man by whom the offense cometh.
It must needs be that offenses come. They have to come. Why? The decree of God. Woe unto the man by whom they come, but they must needs come. There is a determination. And God, in fact, when we talk about permission, language of permission, we're talking about secondary causality. God, all sin arises via secondary causality. Right? So God, in fact, has decreed certain sins be carried out by certain men. And that's all for his greater glory. Even the crucifixion, especially the crucifixion, was carried out by the hands of sinful or wicked men. And yet it's the greatest good that God accomplishes in time, is through that work of redemption in and through Christ. Now, this decree, then, respects not only necessary things, such as burning of fire, you know, the smoke goes up, things sink in water. Those are necessary things, you know, dense things sink in water. But beyond that, it also respects, especially respects, the most free acts of the creature and the most casual things which exist. We'll look at Acts 4:28.
For to do whatsoever thy hand and thy counsel determined before to be done.
The fact is, then, that the most, the free acts of the creature are encompassed by this decree. Proverbs 21:1.
The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord, as the rivers of water. He turneth it whithersoever he will.
Right. So the fact is that God's decree is in fact a decree that respects the free acts of men. God turns that river. Does he stop the river? No, he turns it whatsoever. He directs it. The river's having its free course. But God is directing it to fulfill his decree. You know, you multiply that times all the men on the face of the earth at any given time. He has plenty of choices that he can make as to who to use to do what. So too, we can say the casual acts whereby the will of the creature is not consulted in the determination of the action. Look at Exodus 21:12-13.
He that smiteth the man so that he die shall be surely put to death. And if a man lie not in wait, but God deliver him into his hand, then I will appoint thee a place whither he shall flee.
Yeah, the creature, the will of the creature is not really active in wishing to wishing this ill, right? But God, in fact, his decree not only takes up the free acts of men, but even those casual acts. It's a decree which encompasses both the great actions of men, as we see, for example, in Genesis 50:20.
But as for you, you thought evil against me, but God meant it unto good to bring to pass as it is this day to save much people alive.
As well as the smallest actions, Proverbs 16:33.
The widest chasm into the land, but the boldest person thereof is of the Lord.
So there's nothing so small that it's excluded from this divine determination, Matthew 10:29-30.
Matthew 10:29-30. Are not two sparrows sold for a farthing, and one of them shall not fall on the ground without your father, but the very hairs of your head are all numbered.
So when we talk about this decree, then we need to understand that the decree of God is not taking away the freedom of men or the free will of men, but rather it's establishing that free will. Right? It is the foundation upon which that exercise is being based. Now, again, we're not talking about a libertarian free will. We're talking about the will of man as he exists in a creaturely capacity, right? Man's will is determined already by his desires, by his power to act, and by his opportunity to act. So those things are all part of the decree. God's decree encompasses all of that so that his purposes are being fulfilled 100% without doing any violence to the creature at all. And the creature is very neatly wrapped up in the providence and predestination of God, carrying out God's will, and he's doing it voluntarily all day long. You know, the wicked do what they want to do. They're not doing it to the glory of God. But God will bring glory to himself out of that. God's purpose will stand. You know, their long-term purpose, well, that doesn't fall within their power. You know, they really don't have any power outside of the moment. And all of the variables, in fact, are given to them in such a way that they most willingly fulfill the decree of God. He doesn't need to drag them along to do his bidding against their will. Right? This predestination and this decree of God is a very complex thing as respects the creature. So much so that Joseph can say to his brethren, look, you thought evil against me. Right? You thought you were doing this dirty deed when you put me down in that pit, first of all, then when you sold me to the slave traders and I ended up down here in Egypt. You know, you did all of that. You weren't thinking anything about the glory of God or you were not exercising any kind of goodwill toward me. It was all malicious. But don't worry, because it doesn't really matter what you intended. The fact is, at the end of the day, what God intended by this is what, in fact, is going to fall out. So you thought to do all of these other things, and you did what was within your power. You did it voluntarily. That is, you did it with a free exercise of your will. But your free exercise of your will was not only in no way contrary to ultimately to the secret will of God, it was fulfilling it at every point and purpose. Right. Your purposes were not the ones that were actualized in the end, because it wasn't really in your power to purpose. But God's purposes, they're well within his power to purpose. So they're always falling out in that way. It doesn't matter whether we're talking the great actions or even the smallest actions, you know. And I'm sure I've mentioned this before. There are people who say, well, did God really predestinate the socks that I put on today, or the color of the, you know, whether I'm going to hit a red light or a green light when I come to that? Yes. You look at it as a trivial thing, but you see, it's that fluttering of the butterfly wing that actually impacts everything. You know, hitting a red light versus a green light determines what time you arrive somewhere, and all of the things in between. And all of these things, it's all cumulative. You can't see the purpose of all of that, but it's all cumulative. It's all purposeful. In God's plan, it's all purposeful. He's not doing this in, you know, without some purpose. He's carrying it out. Right? He's decreed the rise and fall of kingdoms and monarchies, princes and potentates. He's decreed whether their government should be mild or tyrannical. Look at Isaiah 40, verses 15 through 17, and Daniel 4:35.
Isaiah 40, verse 15. Behold, nations are as a drop of a bucket, and are counted as a small dust in the balance. Behold, he taketh up the isles of a very little thing. And Lebanon is not sufficient to burn, nor the beasts thereof sufficient for a burnt offering. All nations before him are as nothing, and they are counted to him less than nothing in vanity.
Daniel 4, verse 35, and all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, and he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say unto him, what doest thou?
And there are a lot of people, I think, who would say, oh, yeah, well, they agree that God is sort of in the big stuff, right? There are things, you know, okay, that's important. I can see God being involved in that. Rise and fall empires, yeah, maybe. But look, what we're talking about is not only that. He's not only decreed the rise and fall of empires. And he's decreed all things pertaining to particular persons. In fact, pertaining to every particular person as well. He's decreed, for example, both the time and place of their birth, and whether in a land or a family in which the light of the gospel shines forth, for example, Acts 17:26.
Acts 17:26. And hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on all the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation.
Yeah, he's determined whether or not you're born before the time of the gospel or after the time of the gospel, the time of Christ. He's determined whether or not you're born in a nation where you will even hear the gospel, or you're born in a nation where you will never hear the gospel. Or if you're born in a nation where it's possible to hear the gospel, but not in a family where it's going to be so possible to hear the gospel. He's determined that. He's determined whether or not you're born into a papist or a Protestant nation. He's determined whether or not you're born into a situation where the gospel maybe isn't there yet, but it's going to arrive there during your lifetime. All of these things, all of these variables, these determinations are all made with respect to every single individual particular person ever born into the world. He has decreed all things in the second place with respect to employments and even elevation in his state. Amos 7:14-15.
Amos 7:14-15. Then answered Amos and said, Amaziah, I was no prophet, neither was I a prophet's son, but I was an herdman and a gatherer of sycamore fruit. And the Lord took me as I followed the flock, and the Lord said unto me, go prophesy unto my people Israel.
So he has decreed everything, your time and place of birth and all of that, the land of the family. But beyond that, your employments during your life, what you'll be employed to do, and also whether or not you'll ever be elevated out of that estate. You know, you're going to be a herdman. Well, no, now you're going to be a prophet. Well, those are all in God's hands. You know, those are things that God has, in fact, decreed. He's decreed, in the third place, the relations that they have amongst men, both of wives and of children. Right. Genesis 24:44, Genesis 4:25, and Psalm 127:3.
Genesis 24, verse 44. And she say to me, both drink thou, and I will also draw for thy camels. Let the same be the woman whom the Lord hath appointed out for my master's son.
Genesis 4:25. And Adam knew his wife again, and she bare a son, and called his name Seth. For God said, she hath appointed me another seed instead of Abel, whom Cain slew.
Psalm 127, verse 3. Lo, children are an heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward.
So the decree has to do with the time and place of your birth, employments, elevations in life, relations among men. In the fourth place, it has to do with all of the comforts, both temporal and spiritual.
Isaiah 26, verse 1. In that day shall this song be sung in the land of Judah. We have a strong city. Salvation will God appoint for walls and bulwarks.
Yeah, we have a strong city. Salvation will God appoint for walls and bulwarks. All the comforts that we have, whether the temporal or spiritual, God appoints them. And what that means is that he has appointed whether we're going to be rich or poor or in between. Whether we can extrapolate on this, right? He's appointed whether or not we're born into a place, into a family, whether we're rich or poor, whether we're somewhere in the middle. That's all part of God's appointment. And that's subject to this decree. A fifth, all of the afflictions which are laid upon men. Look at Micah 6:9.
Micah 6, verse 9. The Lord's voice crieth unto the city, and the man of wisdom shall see thy name. Hear ye the rod, and who hath appointed it?
Hear ye the rod, and who has appointed it? Who has appointed the rod? God. And he's appointed, he's decreed the afflictions that are laid upon men. And at last, six, he's also decreed the time of every man's life in this world. Job 7, verse 1.
Job 7, 1. Is there not an appointed time for man upon earth? Are not his days also like the days of the hireling?
Yeah, man's time. So everything about particular persons, the decree of God is touching everything. It reaches to every aspect of your life. It's not just a bare decree, but it's a decree which touches everything that you are and everything that you do. The third, and this is the most controversial, God has decreed the eternal state of all his rational creatures, both men and angels. Romans 9, 22 and 23.
Romans 9, 22 and 23. What if God willing to show his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much long suffering the vessels of wrath fit to destruction, and that he might make known the riches of his glory on the vessels of mercy, which he had before prepared in his glory?
Yeah, now I'm not going to stay on this particular point because this is really something we're going to discuss in more detail next time. But it is important to understand that this decree, these eternal decrees, or the eternal decree, pertains to not only whatsoever comes to pass, but particularly, most particularly, we're concerned with this as it relates to the eternal state of his rational creatures, both men and angels. And that's really where it's going to be the most controversial. Most people are going to find this the sticking point. You know, how can God choose just some people, not everyone? It's not fair. So I don't want to deal with that this week. Lord willing, we'll pick it up next time on that point. But I'm just noting here that this is part of this decree. We can't leave that out. And this is, in fact, the proof text here is found in this, in these questions in the larger and shorter catechism. So the divines had this in mind in particular here. All right, the last question that we want to address briefly. What is the end of the decrees of God? I think we have to say this. The end of the decrees of God is his own glory. Look at Romans 11:36.
Romans 11:36, for of him and through him and to him are all things, to him be glory forever. Amen.
And we need to keep in mind is every rational agent acts for an end, and God, being the most perfect agent, and his glory, the highest end, there can be no doubt then that all his decrees are directed toward that end, that is his glory. For example, Ephesians 1:12.
Ephesians 1:12, that we should be to the praise of his glory, who first trusted in Christ.
So we should be to the praise of his glory. That's God's, the end of his decrees are his own glory. God is a rational being. God is not irrational. And rational agents work toward an end. His work is toward an end. Now, why is that important that we keep that in mind? Because the end to which all of this is tending is actually the underlying reason for the decree. If I ask you why you did X, Y, or Z, you're going to tell me that you did X, Y, and Z to accomplish some purpose, if you're rational. Right? So that God's predestinating, for example, of men and angels, it's not really with an eye to them, but it's with an eye to his own glory. Because his own glory is the highest end possible. And that end, in fact, most conduces to the good of his people. God, in fact, predestines. When we say, you know, why did he do it according to the counsel of his own will, we're really saying he does it when we say we don't know the reason God chooses one man over another. That's not entirely true, because we have to say it's for his own glory. Now, do we understand all that that comprehends? No. But we do understand that it does somehow entail all of these other things that we're talking about. God is working out this decree for his own glory. The glory of God was the end for which he created the heavens. Look at Psalm 19:1.
Psalm 19, verse 1. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork.
Well, the fact is that the heavens were made to declare and manifest to the world the attributes and perfections of the great Creator. That's Psalm 8:3.
Psalm 8:3. When I consider thy heaven, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained.
We can say, in fact, that all of the creation shows some evidence or print of God stamped upon it, whereby they together show forth the wisdom and goodness that frame their very being. Romans 1:20.
Romans 1:20. The invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse.
Okay, so the first thing we can say, God decreed to create all things which have being, right? Why? For his own glory. And the Bible affirms that in a number of different ways, backward and forward. That's why God created, for his own glory. Now, did he do this necessarily? Did he need to do this? No. It's voluntary, remember? This decree is most wise, free, and holy. He didn't have to do it. But when he did it for a purpose, a rational purpose. And the highest, the best rational purpose is his own glory. Likewise, we can say the glory of God was a great end and design in making both men and angels so that they might glorify him. Proverbs 16:4.
The Lord hath made all things for himself, yea, even the wicked for the day of evil.
The Lord hath made all things for himself, even the wicked for the day of evil. He's made all things for himself. Why did he create? For himself. Why does he rule and govern all his creatures that he's made? For himself. His own glory. Even the wicked for the day of evil. Why? For his own glory. Again, did he have to do it? No, no. This is voluntary. Creation is voluntary. We'll stress that when we get to the execution of the decrees in creation and providence. It's voluntary. But again, the highest, most rational end of the voluntary exercise of his will in creating is for his own glory. Right? We can say this is also the end of election and predestination, that God may be glorified in his relations toward the rational creatures. 2 Timothy 1:9 and Romans 9:21.
2 Timothy 1, verse 9. Who hath saved us and called us with an holy calling, not according to our works, but according to his own purpose and grace, which was given us in Christ Jesus before the world began.
God has called forth the people to his own glory. Go ahead and read Romans 9:21.
Romans 9:21. Hath not the potter power over the clay, the same one to make one vessel unto honor and another unto dishonor?
Yeah, but he's being glorified in his relation to the rational creature, but ultimately in calling for the people to his own glory, he's calling for the people to his own praise, to the praise of that glory. Isaiah 43:21.
Isaiah 43:21. This people have an form for myself, they shall show forth my praise.
So God, in all of this, you know, whether we're talking about creation, we're talking about providence, we're talking about decreeing the eternal state of the rational creature, which takes up the whole question of redemption. These are all decrees, if you will, which have for their end the glory of God. God will be glorified in all that he's done in creating and governing and electing a people. Finally, we can say this. This glory, being the end of all things, is the unchangeable expression of the unchangeable God. Psalm 33:11.
Psalm 33:11. The counsel of the Lord standeth forever. The thoughts of his heart for all generations.
The counsel of the Lord standeth forever. That's his heart to all generations. Why is this decree unchangeable? Why does the Catechism talk about it as being unchangeable? Because God himself is unchangeable. Remember, this decree is not, we can't separate the decree from God. This is a problem with Pelagians and Arminians. This is a problem with process theology. The idea that they can separate the works of God from God himself. We can distinguish the works of God from God himself. We can't separate them. Right? We can't separate them because although we can say that they're distinguishable. They're not distinct from. That is, they don't have a separate being apart from God. There is no creation apart from God. There's no providence apart from God. There's no election apart from God. The idea that men would somehow elect themselves or whatever, this is unchangeable because God is unchangeable, right? As nothing can escape his first view, so we should say nothing can be added to his knowledge. Numbers 23:19.
God is not a man that he should lie, neither the son of man that he should repent. Hath he said, and shall it not, and shall he not do it? Or hath he spoken, and shall he not make it good?
Okay, you can't say that God, again, something escaped his view. When he took counsel, that is, when he decrees, I don't even like saying when he decreed, because that implies the idea of time, I think, for a lot of people. The fact is, the decree is eternal. So in decreeing, it's the eternal decree. In decreeing, right, nothing escaped his view. Just because it was future, in terms of the creation, just because it was a matter of potentia, there was a potential, there was a power, it might be or it might not be. Well, that's only if you consider it as potentia, as power. As power not yet actualized. But you see, for God, all that would determine the actualization of that potentia, the power, all of that is, in fact, within the purview of that eternal decree. So there's nothing escaping his first view, and that means that as creation, when creation occurs, and as creation unfolds in providence, there's no knowledge that's being added to God. You know, if you and I do an experiment of some sort, we may gain some knowledge we didn't have before. We work out a mathematical equation, we may gain some knowledge we didn't have it before. We started out with a problem, and we worked our way through that. You know, we generally reason, and reason is horizontal, right? We reason through time. There's a duration. There's a beginning. We begin with something, and we reason upon it. God does not reason through things. God knows everything by direct intuition. There's a direct knowledge. So there's nothing going to be added to his knowledge because there's no place at which he needs to reason. He doesn't need to begin with this and then say, oh, if this, then that. Is it because of God's decree that if this, then that? God is the one who's decreed that causality. God is the one who has also decreed those times when that causality does not quite fall out that way. We call it a miracle, right? So there's nothing that's escaping his view in the first instance. There's nothing going to be added as creation unfolds. Thus, we can say his decree concerning election is irreversible. 2 Timothy 2:19.
Nevertheless, the foundation of God standeth sure, having the seal. The Lord knoweth them that are his. And let every one that nameth the name of Christ depart from iniquity.
The foundation of the Lord is sure. The Lord knoweth them that are his. There's a surety there. There's not. It's irreversible. Why? Again, because nothing escaped his view. There was nothing, you know, when he, as we contemplate this eternal decree, there's nothing from eternity that, in fact, is determined by anything in time or in creation. So there's nothing that escapes his first view, and there's nothing that's going to be added once creation occurs and begins to unfold. He doesn't have to readjust. Again, that's talking about the doctrine of election. We don't really want to focus on that yet. But next time, we do want to take up the question of the decree of God, particularly as it relates to angels and men, because that's where the larger catechism is going to take us. So we'll take these questions up in a little bit more detail next time, Lord willing.
Stillwater's Revival Books is now located at PuritanDownloads.com. It's your worldwide online Reformation home for the very best in free and discounted classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, MP3s, and videos. For much more information on the Puritans and Reformers, including the best free and discounted classic and contemporary books, MP3s, digital downloads, and videos, please visit Stillwater's Revival Books at PuritanDownloads.com. Stillwater's Revival Books also publishes the Puritan Hard Drive, the most powerful and practical Christian study tool ever produced. All thanks and glory be to the mercy, grace, and love of the Lord Jesus Christ for this remarkable and wonderful new Christian study tool. The Puritan Hard Drive contains over 12,500 of the best Reformation books, MP3s, and videos ever gathered onto one portable Christian study tool. An extraordinary collection of Puritan, Protestant, Calvinistic, Presbyterian, Covenanter, and Reformed Baptist resources. It's fully upgradable and it's small enough to fit in your pocket. The Puritan Hard Drive combines an embedded database containing many millions of records with the most amazing and extraordinary custom Christian search and research software ever created. The Puritan Hard Drive has been produced to assist you in the fascinating and exhilarating spiritual, intellectual, familial, ecclesiastical, and societal adventure that is living the Christian life. It has been specifically designed so that you might more faithfully know, serve, and love the Lord Jesus Christ, as well as to help you to do all you can to bring glory to His great name. If you want to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then the Puritan Hard Drive is for you. Visit PuritanDownloads.com today for much more information on the Puritan Hard Drive and to take advantage of all the free and discounted Reformation and Puritan books, MP3s, and videos that we offer at Stillwater's Revival Books.